This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. There are over 1,500 intentional communities in the United States. And in one way or another, these communities try to create something that's missing from our society at large. In the 1940s, Clarence and Florence Jordan started an intentional community in Georgia. The idea stemmed from an absence that Clarence felt deeply.
And in my own home, there was always that tension between the gospel of Jesus and the environment in which we found ourselves.
The community they created was Koinonia Farms. Tomorrow, the Durham Main Library is screening a documentary about Koinonia called Briars in the Cotton Patch, The Story of Koinonia. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove is one of the founders of Rootba House in Durham. Rootba House is among the many intentional communities that have drawn their inspiration from Koinonia. He's also associate minister at St. John the Baptist Church in Durham and author of The Awakening of Hope. Jonathan, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the story of Koinonia.
Koinonia is just a fascinating place because 15 years before the Civil Rights Movement was on the national stage, here was white folks and black folks in rural southwest Georgia sharing life together and doing it because they believed in this concept of koinonia, the notion that Greek New Testament notion of fellowship and community that was possible because of what Jesus had done 2,000 years ago. And Clarence Jordan, who'd grown up in the church, said the trouble with Christianity is that we haven't believed it. We haven't put it into practice. And so they said, we're going to try to just do it. And they did in 1942.
That was a dangerous idea 2,000 years ago, and I suspect no less dangerous in rural Georgia in the 1950s.
Clarence used to tell the story of how the Klan showed up after they'd been there just a little while, and they said, we heard that y'all are eating lunch together over here, and we just wanted to let you know that we don't let the sun set on people like you here. And he said, I gave him my broadest smile and said, pleased to meet you, gentlemen. I've been waiting all my life to meet somebody who can make the sun stand still. And for a while, the Klan was just sort of shocked, and they kind of laughed at him. And it wasn't until about 12, 15 years later, when the Civil Rights Movement was bringing attention to this sort of thing, that the Klan started persecuting them, and they blew up their roadside stands and shot at their houses. And there was an economic boycott against them by the White Citizen Council and Chamber of Commerce there in town.
So what precisely were they doing once they formed this community and this farm?
Well, they were a farm, so they were working together, and working together, they were sharing their income in a way that was, to their mind, much more just than the sort of economic relationships that were there. So black folks got a living wage, essentially, and some of them were sharing homes together there on the farm. So they were sharing life, they were sharing meals, and they would have, you know, Bible study at lunch every day, and they would talk about how they were doing this because Jesus had made it possible for them to be a community together.
To what extent was this a pillar of the Civil Rights Movement? Was it in any way influential in what later became known as the Civil Rights
Movement?
Yeah,
well, it's fascinating to talk to people who went down to organize with, for example, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, because they went into rural counties in Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi, and their task was to try to organize people to get the vote, mostly for African Americans. And when they got to Sumter County, Georgia, they found that, well, here was a place where essentially their message was welcome. And so it became a kind of meeting place and organizing center for the Sumter County movement. And there are lots of stories about how people sort of found respite there. Folks who are well-known now, like Andy Young, say, you know, anytime I got a chance, I went to Koinonia to rest because I knew that it was a little oasis in the midst of the rural South.
But in many ways, this is like the monastic communities of the Middle Ages, a place of rest and safety amidst what was then the chaos of the Western Roman Empire.
That's right. I've called places like Koinonia a new monasticism in America because I really do think that they're living out that same kind of spirit that's been all throughout the history of the church. It's an incredibly important part of the history of Christianity that even when mainstream Christianity was often very compromised, there have been these radical communities out on the edges, and they've had a huge influence on the institution as a whole.
And it's interesting that what happens here is this is a place of where people are living together and working together and creating products together. So it's not just about activism, yeah, and sort of getting voting rights and registering people to vote. People are building trust because they have a community. They live and work together.
Yeah, it's about a way of life. And I think it's why Koinonia's story is so important for us now, because we have made great legal progress since that time in this country. We have an African-American president. I mean, things have changed. And yet the experiment that they were conducting, that experiment of what does it take to actually share life together across these histories of difference and divisions, well, that's the experiment that we're all still involved in, this great experiment of becoming the country that we've not yet been, a country of people who are reconciled across these divisions. And I think Koinonia learned that it's incredibly difficult. And they were being attacked from the outside, but whenever they weren't being attacked outside, they were having squabbles on the inside. I mean, it was a hard thing, but there's a lot of wisdom there.
When you commit to living together in the same space, that's what you have to do. You can't run off to your suburb and say, well, I did my bit for civil rights, now I'm going home.
Yeah,
you do have to work those things out together.
That's right.
You at Rutba House, in many ways, are living this, the extension of this legacy. Tell us a little bit about Rutba House in Durham, and whether you think that this is, in a sense, an offspring of Koinonia.
Well, we certainly do. The division lines are a little different today. What we found is that the great divide is between the people who are homeless and the people who aren't, the people who've been to prison and the people who haven't. And so we're trying to live across that line and learning just what Koinonia learned. I keep very close to me a letter that Clarence Jordan wrote to one of his sons after a couple decades at Koinonia. His son had grown up there and moved away. And he said, I'm coming to realize that Koinonia is always dying and always living again. He says, this half-born condition is agonizing, and I could wish it otherwise, but there it is.
Well, tell us, Rutba House, tell us where it is and a little bit about the
activities. Well, we're in the Walltown community here in Durham, North Carolina, and Walltown is a historically African-American community. It's a community that certainly suffered from Jim Crow back in the day, but is today suffering from the new Jim Crow, from the fact that so many of our young people are whisked off to prison early on in their lives. And when they come back, there's no opportunity for employment. And so so we have some people who've relocated from elsewhere, white folks like me, who didn't grow up in a place like Walltown, but we're trying to live together with our neighbors and with these folks who are coming home and trying to figure out what it means to be a community together for the common good.
Live together, move into the community, because I think that's one of the things that's really absent today. You talked about having an African-American president, and yet in many ways we are more segregated today. Certainly our schools are and our living conditions. The willingness to be with rather than before a community, to move into the community and then work together is, I think, what's radical about your community and others.
Well, it's the greatest challenge, but it's also the greatest gift, because when we are together, I think what Jordan believed and what we've found over and over again is that a mysterious grace shows up, that there's something that makes life possible and transforms all of us, so we're not the same people that we were before. And we genuinely are becoming something new.
With Koinonia, again, located in Georgia, there is a connection, too, with Martin Luther King. He was one of the many civil rights leaders who...
That's right. Yeah. When he was still at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, King had invited Jordan over to give some lectures, spring lectures at the church. It was a rather formal occasion. He came and he talked about his vision of the gospel. And afterwards, they stayed in touch. They even had debates about, for example, the role of the boycott in a nonviolent movement, because King was using the boycott to put pressure on white communities while Jordan and the folks at Koinonia were suffering from a boycott. And Jordan said, it doesn't feel so nonviolent to me.
So they talked, and this was part of King's, in a sense, his radicalization, would you say? Seeing that it's about community as well as activism?
Well, I think King was greatly – what he said to Jordan when he wrote to him is he was greatly encouraged by an experiment, especially an experiment that involved white folks who were voluntarily participating in it. You know, these weren't the moderates that he became so angry at in Birmingham, but these were white radicals who were willing to – voluntarily experiment in integration because of their Christian conviction. And I think King hoped, as Jordan did, that that people who took Jesus seriously would voluntarily do what no law is ever going to be able to make us do, which is to choose life together.
And radical, I suppose, you're thinking about perhaps the radical or root meaning of that word, not so much militant or extreme, but at the root of that religion.
Yeah, that old Latin word radix means root, and it's It's about, you know, getting down to the heart of the thing. And for Jordan, the heart of the gospel was koinonia. It was that possibility of a new fellowship, a new community of people that wasn't possible before. So he used to say, you know, the resurrection of Jesus doesn't mean that Jesus is up on high and you'll go with him when you die. The resurrection of Jesus means that he's alive and he's out here in the world and he's coming to your door and he's probably bringing his homeless friends with him.
So when you talk about these deaths and resurrections of these communities, is there any kind of advancement? Are things moving forward, or is it just kind of cyclical, do you think? Are things any better today?
Well, over the past decade, one of the things we've seen is a great proliferation of these kind of communities. So you quoted that there are 1,500 intentional communities, many of those inspired by faith. And that's a great deal more than there were even 10 years ago. Now, we've had kind of flourishings of these things before. The 70s was another time when there was a kind of new flock of these communities. But I'm greatly encouraged by folks who are finding hope in a way of life. And I even think there's a kind of revival happening in that way, not under the big tent, you know, where you go listen to one person talk, but where people are actually engaging their whole life with their faith in small groups all over the place. Yeah. And I think that's encouraging.
We've got about 10 seconds left, but you got interesting guests coming at the screening of this film at the library, right?
Tomorrow night, downtown in Durham, we're going to have the current director of Koinonia Farm, as well as one of the Jordan sons will be here. And so we'll be talking about Koinonia and talking about community today in Durham.
Jonathan, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Good to be with you, Frank.
Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, Associate Minister at St. John's Baptist Church in Durham, author of The Awakening of Hope, also one of the founders and a resident of Rutba House. Going to be introducing the film Briars and the Cotton Patch, the story of Koinonia Farm, tomorrow, November 20th at 9 o'clock. 29th is tomorrow, 7 o'clock, Durham Main Library tomorrow. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.